Dr. Norman Pollitt, Veal 4.
This experience of yours, you know, not only in Ethiopia, but in the war generally with the FAU, do you think it was important to the rest of your life?
That's the umpteen-thousand-dollar question, isn't it? One will never know. It was an experience, I think, that one would not have wanted to have missed. If for nothing else, I think it was the experience of mixing and learning from other people. I'd been brought up in a fairly sort of parochial existence. In fact, I've been reading a few of my diaries from those days, and I was living a very narrow, parochial sort of existence. I didn't socialise all that much. I had interesting hobbies, photography and music. I played guitar and so on. And I had plenty of friends, but we were in a small group, and the world as such, you know, didn't bother me over much, and world problems didn't bother me over much until the question came whether one should fight or not. And I think not just the medical experience of the unit, but the social experience of the unit has probably taught me a lot. Now, if you ask me what it's taught me, I don't know that I can actually answer that, but I think, I'm sure it has changed me, because I was a fairly introverted individual when I was a young man, kept my thoughts to myself. I was in no way could I be regarded as an extrovert or even an ambivert. But, and I think that's broadened me. But then maybe if I'd joined the Army or the Navy or the Air Force, that would equally have broadened me. Because I think that wars, for whatever the cause, bring together people in the way which nothing else can bring them together. Whether it's a common cause that brings people together, or whether it's just the companionship and the fact that you're semi-isolated but with other people, semi-isolated from your home life or the life you knew, or with other people. I don't know, but there's certainly that aspect of it. So I think possibly the war itself and the life in the unit possibly put more, turn me from being a rather introverted individual into being not extroverted but somewhere in the middle of the road, and made me much more aware of the unimportance of not worrying about what people think, but about the way you behave to other people regardless of what they think. That's put very badly, but I think I was brought up to do things in this way or that way because of what they would think if you did it that way. Now, if I'd stuck to that, I would not have presumably been a pacifist, because my training would have said, ah, what will people think if you do that? So that was the first step in taking a decision and not really caring or not minding what other people thought, although I think possibly one did. It's interesting that after the war, on that aspect, after I'd qualified in medicine, because it was a post-war, because it was the great post-war bulge of doctors, it was frightfully difficult to get into almost any sort of medical job you could think of. And because I qualified, because I didn't take up medicine until I was 28 and didn't qualify until I was 34, obviously, I was taking up medicine rather later in life than most, although not as late as some I've since met. So I was rather late in life, so this meant that I couldn't hang about too long, for example, on the consultant ladder, because this would have meant another 4 or 5 years earning practically nothing, just to get into the consultant ladder, as they called it. So it seemed to me the only sensible thing would be to try and get to the cash box as soon as possible and get into general practice, which would at least bring you an income, you know, within a couple of years of qualifying. And only in those days, the health service had started in 48. I qualified in 1952, so the health service was only 4 years old. with the onset of the health service, the idea of buying and selling practices went out of the window, of course. Doctors were appointed to practices by local committees who would advertise the post and interview applicants just the same as with any other job. And I married in 1953, and I in fact had a period of actual unemployment for several months where I drew the dole while going round applying for practice after practice after practice, till I began to think that, you know, we seriously thought of going to Africa, and where there was plenty of work, or Australia, where they were dying for doctors, literally. I remember going for a practice where there was a short list of about 30, a short list. The original applications ran into hundreds. It was becoming almost impossible. But before applying for these, while applying for these formal practices through the health service committees, naturally I was trying to get work as an assistant or partner, which you still could do by applying to existing practices who would advertise for partners or assistants. And I remember once getting on very well indeed in a very nice practice up in Staffordshire somewhere. Got on very nicely indeed with the senior partner there, and I thought everything was cut and dried, and, you know, we'd be starting. We liked his wife. We stayed there for lunch. Delightful. And at the end of it, he said, "Well, Dr. Ponnett, this has been very helpful, and we'd like to have you here, and I know my partners would like to have you here, but," he said, "there's one thing that bothers me." And he said, "I don't know that your experience in the Friends Ambulance Unit and your history in the war of being a conscientious objector is really going to fit in with us here." But this was the only one. He said, "I hope you'll understand." I said, "Yes, of course I understand." He'd been a colonel in the army or something. I don't know. But that was the only instance I'd met where there'd been any kind of prejudice. Anyhow, I started this question, didn't I? This answer about your answering your question about how it had changed me in any way. And it is difficult to answer. But I think that the experience, whether it had been in the unit or whether it had been in any of the services, I think it's bound to alter anyone's outlook on life, unless they happen to be professional soldiers or professional sailors or professional airmen, because it is such a drastic change from the sort of little, narrow, parochial life that some of us must have been leading. I made a lot of friends in the unit, and those of us who were able, by the relative generosity of the government, to take up medicine because of these grants, I still keep in touch with them, and I think we've all done reasonably well. It's interesting, actually, but I don't know how much the grant was. It wasn't very much. It ran to a few hundred a year. It was just enough to keep you off the breadline. And it paid for your books, I think, I seem to recall, but there wasn't much left for spending money. My family were very good in giving me the odd donation from time to time. But I remember thinking, "Oh, this is wonderful, but what I must do when I qualify, as a gesture of generosity, I must pay this grant back." Of course, I never have. I paid so much in tax, I think I probably paid it back 50 times. But that was the sort of feeling I had, that I didn't feel I was getting something for nothing, but I thought, well, this isn't too bad if one can study medicine and start a career with government help. Of course, these days it's all taken for granted. People expect the government to dole out money for all sorts of things, but that really isn't relevant to this tape, is it? But that's just a feeling. Yeah.
Your pacifism, you know, you mentioned that one instance while you were job hunting.
Yeah.
Has it ever been held against you,
no,
you know, during your professional life? Has it ever been brought up at all?
No. No. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. No. No.
And after the war, you know, I'm thinking particularly when you went from Ethiopia to northwest Germany, northwest Europe.
Yeah.
You must have seen the effects of war very vividly there, I would think, didn't you, with the refugees, the displaced
persons? Yes.
Did that confirm your pacifism, do you think? Did it, do anything to make you think that you were right about war?
No, I don't think it did. I don't think it did. It didn't change my mind on the futility of war. It's very conflicting because coming back from Ethiopia, one of the first things we learnt about at the end of the European war, and don't forget we've been pretty cut off from things. Besides, it hadn't broken in the news then. Were the concentration camps. And then one realised how bestial the enemy had been. And this made one wonder, where does pacifism fit into this kind of thing? You may argue that, the Jews were pacifists, they had to be, because they had no option. But it didn't keep them from the gas chambers. This is a worrying thing. So I say, I don't know whether I would do it again, I just don't know. Some of us in the unit at the time of the fall of France, I say some of us, one or two people I can think of, left the unit after the fall of France. Maybe we discussed this at the training camp. They felt they could not go on as pacifists in view of what had happened to France. Interesting. On the other hand, some people in the army came and joined the unit during the war. I think it's a circle. You go round and round in the argument. You go round and round. But working with displaced persons, I think, just rubbed into me the futility of it all, and where on earth has it all got us? And I think, in particular, the recent Iraq-Iranian war. I think someone has come out in public as saying this is one of the most futile wars we've ever had, if not the most futile. I quite honestly don't know where I stand at the moment. Interesting. But you see, there's a lot of difference between making up your mind academically and making up your mind from a practical standpoint. In 1939, one had to make up one's mind one way or the other. Well, there was no middle course. You either accepted conscription. One might ask oneself, if there were no conscription, would there be any conscientious objectors? Because the conscientious objection is not so much to fighting, but being told to fight. This conscription is what they were against. Whether if there'd be no conscription, and the country had to rely on volunteers, would there have been any war at all, one wonders? I just don't know. But I think you can argue this one to around you blue in the face. But from a personal point of view, if you regard life as being what's the word I want? If you regard the sanctity of human life, if you regard that in every one of us, however bestial he or she may be, to his or her fellow men as having deep within him a spirit which emanates from God or wherever, if you regard life as sanctuous, I don't think it's such a word as sanctuous, but the sanctity of human life, then in no way can you ever take life. I do not hold with capital punishment, but the reason I am against capital punishment is that I, forgetting the fact that I'm a doctor, is that I would not be prepared to take the life of anyone, even on a judicial. I couldn't press the button or flip the trap or give the lethal injection. I could not in any circumstances take life. And I suppose this was at the root of pacifism.
Has it ever...
Doctors, of course, have to take life occasionally. But
yes, this is what my next question to you. Has this ever...
Thou shalt not strive officiously to keep alive, said Hippocrates. So if you've got someone who's actually dying, then there's no point in trying to prolong that life. Where you draw the line on helping the end to come and relieving the pain of the end is terribly difficult. Hence we've got the Bodkin Adamses of this world and so on. I have never in fact done it. I have never in fact helped anyone on their way. I've never actually been asked to. But lots of doctors are asked, of course. And I don't really hold with euthanasia. I think euthanasia is a terribly difficult one because it's going to throw open the whole thing to a lot of abuse. And I think the sort of safeguards you can build into it are going to make life so complicated. It's best to leave things as they are and leave the doctor-patient relationship absolutely as it is. What happens between the dying patient and his doctor is entirely between the dying patient and his doctor and God. And if the doctor sees that by giving that little extra dose of morphine he may be cutting the life short by a few hours, if by doing that he can make the end more peaceable, then it's up to him and his conscience, which brings us back to conscience again, isn't it? What is conscience? What indeed? That's difficult to define.
Yes, and talking of that, you know, and going back to your Judge Hargreaves, I think, at the tribunal... Mm. Do you think they have a very difficult, or they had a difficult task in trying to judge a person's conscience?
I think tremendously difficult task. I don't know how you judge a person's conscience. Or I think what they were aiming to do is to judge sincerity. I think that's what they were after. Sincerity. And trying to weed out those who just wanted to get off it all. Because a lot of conscientious objectors in this last war went to prison. Quite a few. I know of one who went to prison and also took up medicine after the war with a great struggle. Yes. And I know Quakers who fought. So it's a great muddled world, isn't it?
Do you have any involvement with the peace movement today?
Yeah, none whatsoever. None whatsoever.
Do you have any particular feelings about it?
I mean, the women at Greenham Common and so on and so
CND,
forth.
CND, yes.
Ah, now I did indeed have a little bit to do with CND. My first practice in 1954 was in Newmarket, when I took over a single-handed practice, and this didn't do all that well, because the doctor whose death vacancy I had inherited, as it were, had taken himself away from a local partnership and set up in opposition to them. And on his death, the partnership, because months went by, managed to get back most of the patients. That's another story. But during my time at Newmarket, I got to know one or two active people in CND, which was that it's just starting off at that time. And I went to one or two meetings, I think. I was very anti-nuclear then, still am. And I remember with this fellow who was not a doctor, we got hold of some posters which said 4 minutes to annihilation, because this was all the warning that Newmarket, or indeed any part of the country, was going to get once a missile had left Russia. And not far from us in Newmarket was the big American base at Lakenheath. So very early one morning, 4 o'clock I think it was, before even the horses had been taken out to stable, we went through the length of the Newmarket High Street with an estate car and a pot of paste, and on every lamppost, right through the length of Newmarket High Street, we posted up these things saying 4 minutes to annihilation, CND. It took us an hour and a half, I think. And the stable boys started to come out with their trains of horses, looked at us in amazement. And then I just took morning surgery as if nothing had happened. And that week in the paper, there was photographs of these posters. And the town clerk saying, this is preposterous, this preposterous, this sort of nonsense, etc., etc. The Newmarket was very cross about it, because it ruined the look of the place. Anyone tourists driving through to see all these CND posters stuck on the lamppost, and they had quite a job to get them off, but they had them off within a few days. But that's the only involvement I've had with CND. I'm not a member of CND. I suppose I'm still a member of the Peace Pledge Union, because I haven't revoked my pledge of 40X years ago. but I don't have anything to do with pacifist movements at the moment. Not, I just don't. Not because I don't want to. As I say, I think it's a matter of expediency. If another war were to loom up, I think one might perhaps get back into some kind of pacifist propaganda. I don't know. Another war did crop up, of course, the Falklands, didn't it?
Yes, I wonder how you reacted to that.
I thought it was a lot of nonsense. In principle, of course, I could see what the government were arguing about. Here was a British piece of British land, and here was an invader, so he had to be repulsed. There weren't enough people on the island, of course, for them to put into practice any kind of non-violent resistance, were there? It might have worked with the Argentinians, I don't know, if they just refused to cooperate with them. Interesting. I think I'm still ambivalent about it all, which is rather an easy way out, isn't it? Rather an easy way out to be ambivalent.
How do you think the government treated COs in World War II? I dare say you heard about the COs from World War I and how they were treated.
Yes, they were treated rather badly, weren't they?
I personally was
treated well. What it would have been like if I'd gone to prison, if I hadn't accepted the conditions of the tribunal, which were either to go farming or to join an ambulance unit, I didn't specify which one. If I'd gone to prison instead, I would have just been thrown into Wormwood Scrubs or anywhere like that. I suppose I would have been treated like any other prisoner. And I don't think, I wasn't around in 1418, but I don't think from reading that there was anything like the feeling against conscientious objectors that there was in 1418. I'm sure there wasn't. And to answer your question, I'm sure that conscientious objectors in the Second World War were accepted as a natural phenomenon.
How about Ethiopia today? You know, when you see the newsreels, do you relate to it? You know, is it still the country that...
I don't think I'd even want to go back, because it will all have changed so. I don't think it would be a good thing to go back, really. But it horrifies me. I think it's desperately sad, because it was the communists who took over and threw out the emperor. And the country is no better off. In fact, it's worse off. Absolutely worse off. It has to be. Mind you, it's a corrupt... Whichever government in there, it's corrupt. Even when we were there, a little bit of money slipped into the minister's hand would do wonders. And we didn't do it, but I mean, this is what we learned. They are a corrupt lot. No, it's very, very sad. I think the way Ethiopia's gone, very sad. I'd like to go back in a way, but I don't know whether it would be wise to go back.
It's very interesting.
I could just make a fleeting visit, perhaps. But
yes, it's interesting you saying that you didn't see anyone starving. You didn't think there were famines.
No. And we were dotted everywhere. We would have seen them if they'd been there. There was guerrilla activity. There were brigands and tribal warfare. Yes, there was that. Oh, yes.
Were you threatened by brigands ever?
No.
And I was wondering also...
We travelled right through brigand country, too. When I come to think of it, we took an awful risk going back. I remember we were sleeping out in the open on camp beds.
How about
wild
animals?
In the heart of Danalkil country. There were plenty of wild animals, but we were never threatened. I'm trying to think what wild animals. The odd wolf, I suppose. But it's not like some parts of India or Africa. It really is a very interesting area of Africa, I think. Very interesting. Some of our members of that Ethiopian party continued, if I may call it this, the good work long after the war. Both Richie Mansi and another member, Ken Tipper, befriended in a social way and in a practical financial way, a number of young, promising Ethiopian boys and educated them in this country at their expense. One of whom, the Richie educated in this country, became Minister of the Interior until recently, and then he became in charge of the Air Force, but he reached high office in Ethiopia, and he was adopted, in a sense, by Richie, who was a bachelor, and brought over to this country and educated here. I think he educated about 3-4 of these lads. So that was good. One little good thing that came out of it.
Well, Dr. Pollitt, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
There's a lot more one could go on and say, but there's...